like I've been talking to myself again. But it's the only way you're ever gonna learn. You look back and it's all in the past. I'm dwelling on the thoughts I cannot say to you. If I don't say the words, then maybe it's not true. It feels
alright. Hi, welcome along to Steve Wraith's True Crime Podcast, which features on NUFC Matters channel, and it is a very good day to Dr. Sandra Lean. How are you?
Hi, I'm very good, thank you. Yourself?
Very good. Thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. It's taken a while for me to restart the True Crime Podcast because I have been very busy, but there has been a lot of inboxes and social media comments to me to potentially cover a case which you have taken on and written about in this in this book Innocence Betrayed, which is available on Amazon, and you can also order a signed copy from innocence.betrayed@gmail.com. But first of all, before we get into the particular miscarriage of justice that we want to look at today, I just want to just find out a little bit about your background and how you became an expert in the field.
Well, at the beginning, before Jodie Jones was murdered, I ran a natural health centre. So nothing to do with the law, injustice, anything. But this murder happened right on my doorstep. Jodie was found behind the school that my eldest daughter attended. And because of the initial hysteria in the area and all the rumours, and it was just seemed to me like they'd settled on this kid with nothing. And as time went on and he's not getting arrested and the rumours are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and this kid's still going about his normal life, I'm thinking, well, if they caught him red-handed, as they wanted everybody to believe, why hasn't he been arrested?
And to give a bit of background in the case, this is a 14-year-old schoolgirl, yep. Jodie Jones.
Yep.
She was brutally murdered.
And
if you're easily offended, I would cover your ears now. But she was brutally murdered, found stripped naked, apart from her socks. She was beaten. She was strangled. She was almost decapitated. And her body was mutilated after death in a woodland strip behind a wall in East Houses, which is in Midlothian, Scotland. And this is in 2003.
Yep.
A narrow path, which is central to the entire case, reading your notes, ran along the front of the wall and as part of the route Jodie would have taken to meet a boyfriend, Luke, that night.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about Luke. He was 14 at the time, wasn't he? And he was treated as a suspect.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know either family at the time. But this lad, Jodie didn't arrive home on time. So our mum texted Luke's phone because Jodie's phone was broken and said, right, up the road, you're grounded. So Luke immediately phoned her mum and said, I haven't seen her. She didn't turn up. She was supposed to arrive at round about tea time, and she didn't turn up. And Luke basically thought he'd been stood up and went off to play with his pals in the local abbey, which is just across the road from where he lived. That set the alarm, and three members of Jodie's family, Luke said he would come up the path that Jodie would have taken, and if he didn't find her, go to her mum's, and basically the adults would decide what to do next. Three members of Jodie's family came from the other end, so a place called Mayfield, and intercepted Luke at the top of the path, insisted on a double check. When they went back down, his dog reacted. Luke doubled back and went over the V in the wall, because it's a really high wall. So this was a bit that he could get through. Found Jodie. The police were called, and from the minute they arrived, they started to treat Luke differently from the other searchers. So he was the only child there, but it was him that they asked to go back over the wall and show them where Jodie was, even though three of the four of them had been over the wall. They separated the other three family members and took them to a car park at the back of the school, but kept Luke separate and then put him in a police car and off to the station where he was stripped, he was swabbed, he was questioned till 7 o'clock the following morning, while the other three went home. They didn't take their clothes, their phones, statements. It was something like 5 o'clock the following morning before they thought might be an idea to get the statements of the other three people who were present when Jodie was found. So straight from the beginning, they were gunning for this lad.
I mean, it's a strange situation, you know, this kind of thing, to hear that the police would even, you know, do that. I mean, 2003, we're living in different times now, 19 yes. years on. But, I mean, were his parents notified about this?
His mum and dad were separated. He lived with his mum. Okay. His mum was trying to call him after he'd gone out looking for Jodie, because time was passing and time was passing. And eventually, a policeman took Luke's phone from him, switched it off, switched it back on, told them to dial his mum's number, and then said to his mum, make your way to the police station. So that was how his mum found out that he was in a car and being taken off to the police station. But they didn't wait for her to arrive before they stripped him. By the time she got there, he was already in the white suit. And you know, like when they questioned him that night, they had them in a big room and they had Luke at one end and his mom at the other, speaking to two different officers. So here's a 14-year-old lad who's found his girlfriend brutally murdered. He's whipped off to the police station. He's got no support. There was never anybody brought in to check his, I suppose, psychological or emotional state. They did bring in a doctor to examine his body for any signs of injuries that might connect him to the murder, but he got no support that night whatsoever.
Wow. I mean, that's crazy. So I presume after that initial questioning session at the police station and, you know, the various, you know, various other things that they would have done with him, he would have been released then, was it under investigation?
No. At that point, they kept telling him he was just a witness.
Ah, right, okay.
So
okay.
Off he went, and 4 days later, first, second, third, on the 4th, on the Friday, so Jodie was found on the Monday night. So this was into the Tuesday morning that he was in the police station till 7 o'clock in the morning, and they sent him home. And then on the Friday, they raided his home in a blaze of publicity, officers taking bags and bags of stuff that they were calling evidence. But they called it a voluntary attender interview and again told him he was a witness, but carried out the interview under caution. So now there's this question of, well, what is he? Is he a witness? Is he a suspect? The family had never had any dealings with the police or crime, so they didn't know what the process should have been. But by that Friday, that was him firmly in the public eye as suspect number one, with not a scrap of evidence against him. They had nothing.
And that's the thing that I found astounding about this case, because at the time he was 14, and, you know, this big public raid, of course, is going to attract the attention of the media.
Yeah.
And what I find shocking is that his name, photograph, his home address, and his school were all released in the media, in the newspapers.
Yep. And from then to this day, the media have just hounded and hounded and hounded this family. It was a trial by media. Luke himself said in an interview, which was a trick, on the day of Jodie's funeral, he was told he wasn't to attend the funeral because it would turn it into a media circus. That was what he was told. So after all the mourners had gone, that afternoon they were having, he and his mum had a little vigil in the house for Jodie, and Sky News tricked their way into the house and then started asking him questions that he would have to have been asked under caution by the police. So this is the media ramping up and ramping up and ramping up. So the headlines the following day were, you know, how could you? And, you know, talking about him goading Jodie's fact. This kid had not been charged with anything. This was the September. They still had nothing, no evidence whatsoever on him. And yet the media were allowed to just keep up this campaign of finger pointing, name calling, printing rumours about the family. That it was a kind of circular thing, because we know the police were feeding the media, which was winding up the local community. And then the rumours started and they were going back to the media and getting fed back to the police. It was an absolute mess. And this was, well, I mean, Luke was only 15 when he was finally arrested in the April of the following year.
So he's arrested in the April, as you say, and yeah. You know that 3 month gap between his arrest and him turning 16, there was a little rest, you know, from the media. But then as soon as he turned 16, they were back to pointing the finger at him as a killer.
Yeah, after they arrested him, they said he couldn't be named for legal reasons. They'd named him and photographed him for 10 months prior to that, but once he was arrested, oh no, can't name him. And then when he turned 16, boom. And that was another little bit of trickery because he was tried as an adult. He turned 16 before the trial. So he was tried as an adult. Even though the claim was that he committed the crime when he was 14, he was a child. So...
Okay. So you've highlighted to me a few major issues with this case, and like every miscarriage of justice, I mean, I've been involved in a couple of high profile cases where I've looked at them myself as somebody who reports and who can pick out the faults with a lot of cases. Yeah. But this one is fairly damning for me reading through it. I mean, first of all, let's look at the main witnesses against Luke Liddon's court case.
Yeah. So. The three family members of the search crew, that was Jodie's gran, Alice Walker, her sister, Janine, who was 17, and Janine's boyfriend, Stephen Kelly, who I think from memory was 19 at the time. So they're the three from Jodie's family that go out looking for her. Meet Luke at the top of the path, down they go, dog reacts, and everybody tells the same story for the first month. They went down past the V-break, the dog reacted, Luke doubled back, and then Stephen Kelly, the sister's boyfriend, went over, and then the granny went over. Everybody tells the same story for a month. And then after the first month, the stories start to change, and they start to say the dog didn't do anything. The dog didn't react. Luke just went straight over the wall, and that was then used at trial to make the claim that Luke led them straight to the body because he knew where it was. And he could only have known where the body was if he was the killer. So all three go from saying the same as Luke to saying something completely different. And by the time they get to trial, that's their story. Now, a lot of people don't understand the thing about statements being adopted on the stand. So the defence tried to say, but hang on, you said this. And they were saying things like, that's not what I meant, or, you know, they must have picked it up wrong, to try and get away from the fact that they were saying the same as Luke in the beginning. But on the stand, if they don't accept that original statement, can't be used as evidence. They have to agree. Sorry.
No, go on.
No, just they have to agree that that's what they said. If they don't agree that that's what they said, can't use it.
The stuff about the path, again, is something which, you know, was highlighted to me within the stuff that you sent over to me. And that is that, you know, Jodie could have been snatched at any point along the road, yet the search trio were only going to look on the path that they had no idea Jodie was going to be using. So your suggestion is that they knew, or they strongly suspected that Jodie was attacked on the path, but at the time they set out to look for her, you know, they didn't know that she'd been attacked and they didn't know that she'd be on the path at all.
Absolutely. They had a 20-minute walk from where they were to the path, and that was through playing fields and some woods and, you know, that's the area that Jodie should have been in. And they didn't look for her at all. They didn't call out for her. They were making their way straight to the path. And then the sister said at trial, at the other end of the path, the new battle end where Luke lived, that road down there is also woodland either side. So she could have been snatched anywhere. But the sister said at trial, we weren't going all the way to New Battle. We were only going to the path. Well, that says to me, they had a 20-minute walk this way and about another 7 or 8 minute walk at the other end of the path. they knew Jodie didn't get off that path. Before they headed out, they knew, because they were only going to the bit in the middle, the path. Question is, how did they know?
Okay.
I mean, that was within 15, 20 minutes of them finding out that Jodie hadn't been with Luke, and then they set off. So why? Why did they go directly to the path?
Well, I mean, why would the family concoct a story? I mean, you know, it is quite confusing that a family would even contemplate changing the version of events. You know, is it because the police have, you know, are suggesting that he is the murderer and this would have to fit that kind of event? Is it because, you know, another reason? I mean, why would they do that?
I don't think it's necessarily a conscious thing. And I have seen this in other cases where the police want to push their narrative, their version of events. And this is a family in total despair. They're distraught. They're shocked. And it's little things like the police say, oh, are you sure it was that? Could it have been that? They introduce the confusion first and then gradually lead them towards, oh, yeah, you could be right, actually. Maybe that didn't happen. That becomes a definitive statement. But, you know, most people in this line of work will tell you the first statements are the most reliable because there's been nothing else to interfere with them. So I think we know the police were telling people from day two that Luke was the killer and they'd have him by the end of the week. They'd arrest him by the end of the week. They were just gathering the evidence. So if they were telling other people that, I have no doubt they were telling Jodie's family that. And I think just the psychological process of, you know, causing them to doubt their initial stories and adding little bits on. But that still doesn't take us away from they went directly to the path. And no one
else. Did Luke have any previous?
No.
Nothing at all?
No. So, okay. Again, you know, it makes it... One of the things that I've found over the years is that there were members of Jodie's family and extended family who definitely did have aspects of the life, shall we say, that might have suggested that the police should have at least had a look and ruled them out. But this is the thing as well. They didn't. They were so focused on Luke. Other people who should have been persons of interest, other places that should have been places of interest, were just ignored. They didn't even check. And that's why over the years, as I found out more and more of what wasn't done and who wasn't looked at, for me, you know, people say, oh, how do you know he's innocent? Well, I don't. Nobody does. But I do know that that conviction is not safe. Not with all of the evidence we have now that should have been checked out and just wasn't.
The police were working on three incorrect pieces of information as well. And you know, two of them supplied by Jodie's mother.
Yes.
Take us through them.
When they arrived at the point where the searchers were, the first officer radioed in, oh, there's a couple other people here, the gran and the sister. So he clearly was unaware that there were four of them. But then you look back and Luke's was the only number given to the police by Jodie's mum. And they didn't know the other three were out searching. So I can only assume they weren't told that the other three were out searching because they were looking for Luke. The only number they had was Luke's. And this officer was surprised that the other three were there. One of the officers left Jodie's mum's house after getting the missing persons details, left Jodie's mum's house under the impression that Jodie had left her own home at tea time with Luke. And now Luke was saying he hadn't seen her. No wonder they were suspicious. You know? But he didn't leave Jodie's house with her. Jodie left alone. Luke was at his own house at the other end. But this officer seemed to think that Jodie had left with Luke at tea time, and now he was saying he hadn't seen her. The other thing that Jodie's mum told the police was that Luke was coming up the path that night on his bike. Now, again, if you're talking about why were they suspicious, this kid's belting up the path on a push bike and suddenly stops in the pitch dark, climbs over the wall and finds a body because they don't know the other three were there. Again, you'd be saying, why? Why did he stop and climb over the wall? What reason was there? But of course, he wasn't coming up the path on his bike. He was coming up with his dog. And Jodie's mum couldn't explain why she'd said he was coming up on his bike when she knew he was coming up with his dog. So, yeah, right from the off, that there was misinformation swilling about there. Those officers were acting on that as if it was accurate. And you can see just from the couple of things that I've just said, why they'd be thinking, oh, wait, there's something a bit strange here. And then they kind of just rolled with it, unfortunately. By the time they were putting out news stories saying that they were just waiting for the forensics to come back to confirm their main line of inquiry. And then the forensics came back with nothing on Luke. Nothing. No forensic evidence to link him to the scene or vice versa. Did they go back to square one and start again? Nope. By then, they'd wrecked the crime scene. They'd let other trails go cold. They'd missed the opportunity to gather other evidence. So they were stuck with it. They could hardly come out and say to the public, we can't investigate this now because for the last 2 weeks, we've let everything else go because we thought the forensics were going to come back on this guy. So it just built from there.
I mean, you mentioned earlier about him being taken in as a voluntary attender interview. Where he was there for 6 hours. His home was searched. The media plastered pictures of him, the white suited officers carrying bags, you know, which they called evidence from his mother's home. But the same day that they were doing that, they put out an appeal for two boys on a moped, which was seen propped against the V-brake in the wall on the afternoon of the murder to come forward. So tell us about them.
Yeah, they waited until after Luke was released and then they put this appeal out for the moped boys, as we call them now. So these two lads came through a local tool hire place on an old cobbled together hand-built moped that kept cutting out, really, really noisy. And the tool hire staff all gave their statements to the police saying it was 5 o'clock, it was closing time. The moped was then seen at the V-break in the wall, but the two riders were not there. The two boys were not there. So the appeal went out for them on the 4th and they came forward on the 5th and the 6th to be eliminated from the inquiry by the Monday morning, the 7th. These two, one of them was Jodie's cousin and the other was slightly more distantly related. But one of them said the reason they hadn't come forward was because his gran, who is Jodie's gran, told them not to because they'd been on the path too early. Weeks and weeks later, the police discover that they lied about the time they were on the path and removed themselves from what would eventually become the exact claimed time of death. And again, you've got that. Why did they place themselves an hour early, 45 minutes earlier than they were actually on the path? And then the grand says, don't go forward, you were there too early. What if, you know, they'd seen somebody skulking about, even if it was too early? But that was the reason for not coming forward. And it was put to them by the defence on the stand. You know, did you have anything to do with it? And of course, they both said no. They're hardly going to go, well, actually, now that you mention it. So again, we've got these two guys who are at the actual V point in the wall. Jodie was 16.3 metres down from the V on the other side of the wall. So they're there at the exact, the moped's there at the exact time the police claim Jodie was being murdered. And they don't know where they were. Their bike's there without them. They don't know where they were. They can't say what they were doing. They can't remember anything at all. And then they take 5 days to come forward. And still, they were eliminated by the Monday morning, before the police even realised that they lied about the time they were on the path. It's the most bizarre set of circumstances. These two also gave evidence against Luke at trial. One of them was facing a serious assault charge against a female at the time he gave evidence against Luke. Another female, obviously.
Yeah.
So, again, most people think when they're called to give evidence, they've got to be reliable to agree. I can't see how these two could ever be considered reliable witnesses in those circumstances.
And Luke's use of cannabis, that also became central to the official narrative, but John Ferris played a part in that as well, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's... The impression given was that Luke had led Jody astray and got Jody using cannabis because he used so much of it himself, and it was cannabis that made him do what he did and all of this.
They called him a local dealer.
Yeah, yeah. But then we find out that actually Jody used cannabis before she met Luke, and she got her cannabis from her cousin, John Ferris, one of the moped boys, who was also supplying all the other youngsters in the area with cannabis. So straight away you've got a dealer accusing Luke of being a dealer on the stand. But then we found out that the morning Jody was murdered, so the morning of June 30th, 2003, John Ferris and Jody's brother Joseph received a 9-bar of cannabis. And the two of them walked down to Jody's mum's house with said 9-bar. Ferris openly admits cutting bits to take to various different people and everything else. And yet they claim Luke was the local dealer. And I believe that never came out at trial. The stuff about the 9-bar never came out at trial. But Ferris said on the stand that he'd stopped dealing by the Christmas. So the police want us to believe that Luke is a suspect by the 3rd of July. And yet they're watching him constantly. They're allowing John Ferris to supply him with cannabis for the next 6 months. And nothing said or done about it. And then they charge Luke the following April with supplying cannabis. It's almost, you know, if you were to take that to its logical conclusion, that's entrapment.
And the charge disappeared for John Ferris, which often happens in these cases where...
The violence charge wasn't against Ferris. Mm-hmm. It was against the other... Mm-hmm. The other male, but Ferris was never charged with anything concerning cannabis at all, ever.
Wow. So 6 weeks after the murder, Luke's home was raided again. He was taken in for what was known as a Section 14 interview. Tell us what that is.
They were legal in Scotland right up till 2011. And basically it means that the police can take anybody, including children, in for questioning. They can hold them for 6 hours with no access to legal advice or representation. So no lawyers present. And they have them in that room for 6 hours. That, the transcript of that interview, the appeal court judges said the behaviour of the police officers was outrageous and to be deplored. And then concluded that there wasn't anything untoward about it, shall we say, because Luke gave as good as he got. three seasoned cops, one 15-year-old boy. And the judges decided that no harm was done because he gave as good as he got. I mean, that's the very fact that they said it was outrageous and to be deplored should have meant that any of the evidence from there shouldn't have been allowed to be used at trial because it was improperly obtained. Because they goaded and goaded and goaded. There's one passage where this cop has, he's lost his sanity, basically. And I'm telling you, and it was throwing, and you're like, what is he saying? Not a breath to allow Luke to answer anything. He just keeps going and going and going and going. And then when Luke reacted and said, you know, I can't tell you because you'll not let me speak, they played that to the jury to make him look like he was belligerent and had no respect for authority and all that sort of thing. At one point during that interview, they played him a video with a dummy to try and prove that Luke couldn't have seen Jody from where he said he saw her. So as they're playing this video, Luke goes, stop, stop. Like, freeze it. And they go, no, 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 we'll just keep playing, we'll just keep playing. And he's like, no, you need to go back, I can show you. And they told him that the video player didn't have a rewind facility so that he couldn't show them that he could see it from where he said he could see it. And then they get to the end of the tape and they go, see, we told you, you're lying. You could not possibly have seen the body from that distance. And yet they wouldn't rewind the tape for him to go, there it is. It's the most horrendous interrogation of a child I think I've ever seen. It was absolutely outrageous. But they were allowed to use it.
You mentioned earlier about the forensic tests coming back, you know, with, you know, no evidence against Luke, but there was some DNA and a DNA profile of another male found on the T-shirt that Jody was wearing that night. Who did that belong to?
That belonged to Stephen Kelly, Jody's sister's boyfriend. Now, they went to the most incredible lengths to explain that away. First of all, when the DNA results came back, the police went to the sister's boyfriend and offered him an innocent explanation that the DNA could have got transferred on the T-shirt in a wash cycle, and that Jody might have borrowed one of her sister's T-shirts without her sister knowing about it. This is, you know, the convoluted way they tried to explain away his DNA is that it was the sister's T-shirt and his DNA got transferred on it in a wash cycle, and then Jody had worn it. And then they tried to claim further that the rainwater, because Jody's body was left out uncovered, the whole scene was left out uncovered the whole night. One of the forensics officers couldn't get over the wall and went home, and she was just left out. It's so disrespectful, apart from anything else, left out in the rain the whole night. So then they tried to claim that the DNA could also have been transferred from its original place, from the washing machine, by rainwater. And that transferred it to other bits in the T-shirt. They made a couple of mistakes there. First of all, none of the other samples on the T-shirts were full samples. So they actually implicated Kelly in the other samples when they shouldn't have done that, because they were partials. You can't say a partial belongs to somebody. The washing machine one, the full sample, that's how they said it got there, was from the washing machine. But there's no DNA of the sister on the T-shirt. And you'd think if it was her T-shirt and his DNA survives, something of hers would have survived a wash as well. But no, there's nothing of her.
I think the other thing I found fascinating about the scene of crime was that it was actually bleached.
Ah, yes. Now, Scott Forbes did some amazing work on this, because for years we knew the scene had been bleached because the police dog handlers' reports are in the case files, and they say the scene had been bleached in a particular area. and the dog's work was hampered by that. And then Scott discovered that poachers and gamekeepers and, you know, people that do that sort of thing have a process whereby they'll bleach the scene of a kill so that when the gamekeeper's dogs come and try and, you know, track where it happened, they can't find it because they go nose blind with the bleach. And one of the boys on the moped, his dad was down over the wall that night with 8 working spaniels. This is after Jodie's supposed to have been killed, but within an hour or so, 8 working spaniels, and not one of them reacted according to this guy. They didn't alert him to anything. 8 working dogs within meters of a badly mutilated 14-year-old girl, and the dogs didn't respond. But he was familiar with poaching and gamekeeping practices. So for the first time, we had to consider, actually, did the police bleach the scene? Or was it somebody else entirely? Because you'd think it'd be incredibly stupid of them to bleach the scene and then bring in dog handlers from down south, knowing they'd get found out, because the dog handlers would say it was bleached. So now you have to wonder, was it them? We know there were other people at the murder scene. It doesn't help that the police took this guy's dad, this guy, back to the murder scene as an expert. So again, you know, anything that is found there, he's got an innocent explanation for it. The police took him back.
In 2014, there was a man who was known as the Stocky Man by the defence, I noticed in your notes. And it turned out that this was Jodie's brother, Joseph, and he had an illness, didn't he?
Yes. I need to be a bit careful what I say about that. But yes, he had mental health issues, quite serious mental health issues. And this Stocky Man had been in the case files from the beginning. 2 independent witnesses, one of them who knew Jodie, said they saw this man walking closely behind Jodie just after she left her home, about 5 past 5. And the other thing about this case is the timings are all over the place, because they had to work backwards from 5:15 to make it fit so that they could say it was Luke, because he was alibied for the rest of the evening. So they needed this window, and they kept moving the times around. So anyway, these 2 people saw this guy, and we were always told he'd never been identified. Nobody ever found out who he was. And then when the case went to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, they came back in 2014 and said, oh, no, one of the witnesses actually went back to the police and said, I think I know who he is now, and pointed out this male in a group of males, quite similar looking, all short, dark hair, because it was, you know, it was media coverage. And she went, that one there, it's him. And it's him that she pointed out was in fact Jodie's brother. So they'd had that information all the time, and the defence knew nothing about it. So again, the eyewitnesses who were used at trial are just laughable. The first one is a lady at the East House's end, Jodie's end, who said she was driving around a really tight bend with 2 kids in the car, and she saw this couple at the entrance to the path. But she didn't see their faces, and, you know, she described a guy that was older than Luke, wearing fishing-style clothing with thick hair sticking up in a clump at the back. Luke was 14, poker-straight blonde hair. So this is her description. The police After the Section 14 interview, the police took a Polaroid picture of Luke, inserted it in a spread where 11 other boys who were much younger had shorter hair and on dark backgrounds. So this Polaroid of Luke was, you know, standing out. And she said that he's the most like the person I saw. But she'd said previously she could only describe him from his clothing. And her man is wearing fishing style jacket and trousers. And in this picture, Luke's wearing a black t-shirt. So she's not identifying him from clothes. And she said the reason she picked him out was he had the same shape of face. That's her identification. We were told, excuse me, we were told she was wholly independent, that she had no connection with Jodie's family whatsoever. And then we found out that her brother-in-law was in Jodie's gran's house on the morning of July 1st, telling them about her sighting. He was in Jodie's mum's house on the 4th of July, telling the family there about her sighting. And he was present when she made her two statements to the police. That doesn't sound entirely independent to me. And any information going back and forward because of this brother-in-law is bound to have had some sort of impact on her recall. How could it not? And then at trial, she failed to pick him out in the dock. We still have dock identifications in Scotland. And they said to her, do you see the person you saw that day anywhere in the room today? And she said, no.
What sentence did Luke get?
Minimum 20 years, but his actual sentence is without limit of time. So forever is the bottom line on that one. He won't take any of the offender behaviour courses because as far as Luke's concerned, he has no offending behaviour to address. And if he doesn't take them, he can't progress through the system for parole because the question at parole will always be, how can you demonstrate a reduction in your risk to the public? If you weren't a risk to the public in the first place, how do you demonstrate a reduction in that? And the only process is by taking these offender management courses, and he won't take them because that's not just Luke. I know a lot of people maintaining innocence who will not take these courses because it's then used against them. If you're saying you didn't do it, why are you taking this course to address behaviour that you see, you know, wasn't part of your personality or whatever? So that then just goes round in circles. And that can go round in circles for years because there's no place in the prison system to address innocence.
A documentary was released called Murder in a Small Town. This gave support for an independent review of the case, and the interest in that grew rapidly. But Police Scotland issued a statement, didn't they, saying that they essentially believed that the right person was convicted and that there was no need for a review, and constantly putting out the same press release and the same line each time any mainstream media takes this on. So where do we stand at the moment with Luke's case?
Well, we had some interesting developments just in the last couple of weeks. We found out that the police had started to destroy the evidence in this case.
Really?
Yeah. So we'd been making it clear that we were looking for an independent review, that we would be asking for samples for retesting with modern techniques. And Police Scotland were making public statements on media articles talking about that. So there's no way they could say they didn't know that there were going to be further proceedings in this case, which is the only way they can destroy evidence. So after 12 years after the end of proceedings is the first point at which they're allowed to start destroying evidence. And before they destroy it, the Procurator Fiscal signs off what can be returned to the owners and what gets destroyed. So they then have to contact the owners and say, do you want it back or will we destroy it? They bypass that whole process. They should, the last proceedings for Luke were 2014. So even if we had nothing else imminent, they should have held the stuff until 2026. And this year, they started destroying it. And we found out and we got it stopped. So we have no idea what's gone, what's still there. We don't know. And you'd have to ask the question, we've been saying we want these samples released for retesting. If those samples are some of the first evidence destroyed, what would that say? Mm. What message would that give? But currently, at the minute, we don't know what's been destroyed and what's still there. All we know is that they've put a stop to the destruction for the time being. We're now asking for an inquiry into why that even happened. Why did they start destroying the evidence? We did find out as well that, as a result of that, that there's stuff in the police files that the defence has never known about. So, for example, there's reference to psychological reports on Jodie that the defence knew nothing about. There's the whole parka jacket saga, where they claimed that Luke's mum burnt a parka jacket in his back garden because that's what he was wearing when he murdered Jodie, and then she bought him a new one to disguise the fact that she'd burnt the original one. Yeah, slight problem with that. There is zero forensic evidence of any clothing being burnt in the log burner in the back garden. It's a little, yeah, maybe 11 inches across, and this is a huge parka jacket. Anyway, chief investigating officer said on the stand, under oath, there were no other warrants issued, no other houses searched under warrant other than Luke's mum's and Luke's dad's. We find out that there was another warrant, at least one that we know of, where they went after one of Luke's school friends who did have a parka jacket, was known to have a parka jacket prior to the murder. And they seized his jacket, and that's been in the evidence for nearly 20 years. So there's just so much coming out now. You know, we're finding out about stuff that we just never knew existed.
The fishing knife, you think, would be rather important and something that you wouldn't misplace, but they claimed it didn't exist until suddenly it comes to light that it's been in the files all along.
Yes. So the part of their story was that they found this pouch, this knife pouch, and said never got the knife that fitted the pouch. So, you know, where was it? Trying to imply that that was the murder weapon. The pathologist himself was shown a similar knife and he said it's too small. It wouldn't be capable of inflicting the injuries. But they ran this whole line at trial that this missing knife was probably the murder weapon and where was it? He had the pouch and not the knife. But I knew because I was there when Luke's mum, Corinne, handed the knife to the solicitor, and the solicitor took it to the police station, and his statement is in the case files saying, here's the knife that belongs to the pouch. Just because they weren't together doesn't mean the knife was missing. They ignored all that. I've been called a liar for nearly 20 years for saying, I've seen the statement. No, you haven't. You know, there was the knife was missing. And then we find out that, yeah, actually, they had it all along, and it was swabbed, and well, no results given to the defence. I wonder why that would be.
The last piece of information I'd like you to share is just about the student at the nearby college who was brought to the defence's attention in 2006. Tell us about him.
And again, that's down to Scott. Scott brought this guy to the police attention on a number of occasions. So he called the police, and he also took this guy to the police station because he turned up at Scott's flat. He lived, he was residential in New Battle Abbey, which is just 500 yards from the murder scene. And he turned up at Scott's flat the following day with scratches on his face, a bloodshot eye. He was behaving really erratically and he couldn't remember where he'd been the night before. So Scott tried to bring that to the attention of the police. He tried to bring it to the attention of Luke's legal team. Eventually, 2006, they decided they were going to listen to him. And he said he wrote an essay. The student wrote an essay about killing a female in the woods. And when it got to appeal, they absolutely trashed Scott. Absolutely trashed him. Said that they'd made the story up because they were going to go to the papers and get 50,000. All right, so the student is going to walk into the police station and say, yeah, I've got scratches on my face and I don't know what I was doing and yada, yada, yada. And when they clear him, they're going to get 50 grand for the newspapers. He'd have to be some sort of imbecile to agree to that. You know, it never happened. But this is what they used at appeal to dismiss it. 2 years later, I get the case papers and every single thing Scott Forbes said was followed up, was confirmed in those case papers. So at appeal, they said that the essay about killing a female in the woods, that no such essay existed, right? But they referred to the title as Killing a Girl in the Woods. They said that's what the title was. And again, we just found out that there are two versions of the essay in the police files, but they're not called Killing a Girl in the Woods. They're called No Remorse. But they're there. So another little technicality, another little tweak. It wasn't called that. So an essay of that title does not exist is true. Is there an essay about killing a female in the woods? Yes. It's just got a different title. So, you know, like I said, everything that's been rubbished by them over the years, we've eventually found either stuff in the case files or different witnesses that were ignored at the time. Mm-hmm. And so many of them have come forward since the documentary just to say, yeah, hang on, can I tell you this? Because they wouldn't listen to me at the time. There will be more on that in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, so the student, they just dropped all interest in them. On the basis of this £50,000 story, which is utter nonsense. And then, like I say, you find out that everything Scott said, the other witnesses to this guy's injuries and to him behaving erratically are in the files right from the beginning. There's other people, somebody else in Scott's flat who saw him that day in the files. And of course, this guy was known to wear a parka jacket and admitted that he was running on the New Battle Road that night. Now, that's not to say he had anything to do with it, but two witnesses at the New Battle end said they saw Luke leaning against a gate on the New Battle Road. And this guy looks very, very similar to Luke. And he's wearing a parka jacket. It could simply have been a mistaken identity. But when I put that to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, their response, it was the most bizarre thing. The response was, well, that's irrelevant because he wasn't a suspect. How can a mistaken identity be irrelevant just mm-hmm. because the other person's not a suspect? It's crazy.
It's an incredible case. You know, it's fascinating hearing your insight into it and laying out the facts that you have managed to discover. And as you've mentioned, lawyer and author Scott Forbes, who has been involved since the beginning,
yes,
has recently carried out his own independent investigation into some aspects of the case.
Oh, he did a fantastic job.
And he's published his findings in another book called A Long Walk to Justice, which you can get on Amazon. I'll post the links below. And as I mentioned at the start of the programme, your book, Innocence Betrayed, covers as much of the known information as you could publish up to 2018 when the case was published. What's Luke's mindset like? And what are the next plans that you have that you can tell us, those that you want to share, and how can people, you know, support Luke and the Miscarriage of Justice?
At the minute, the discovery of the destroyed evidence has changed the layout a little bit. Our next move would have been to take a new application back to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, but now we're calling for an inquiry into the destruction of the evidence, because in terms of his human rights, if they've destroyed the evidence that would allow him to prove it wasn't him, where does he go from there? So we now have to look at, is it going to be a human rights appeal? Do we go back to the commission as part of that human rights appeal? So it's quite a, you know, we have to choose the right path for the best way to deal with all of it, because we don't want people wriggling off the hooks here just because the time bars or anything like that. So in terms of supporting, we do have a campaign, people writing to MPs at the minute, but they'll only take letters from Scottish constituents. But there is a petition on change.org, which I will send the link for you. It's over 25,500 at the minute. We handed it into the Parliament a couple of weeks ago, but we left it open in case they tried to stall with a response. And then all of this stuff came out. So what we're saying is, add your names and just let them know that we are not accepting that sort of behaviour from our police or our justice system. When there's a 14-year-old girl who's never had justice, and there's a 14-year-old lad whose life has been absolutely ruined for a crime that all of the evidence says he didn't commit.
Fascinating insight, Dr. Sandra Lean. Thanks very much. The link's below for the books if you want to read more about this case. But thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
A big thanks to all our sponsors. First off, Skips and Bins, telephone 0800 25 45 25 3, email inquiries at skipsandbins.com, website skipsandbins.com, easy contract free and pay-as-you-go waste collection. Thanks to Garden of Healing Dispensary, CBD Hemp and Cannabinoid Specialists. You can find them at thegohd.com. And thanks to Mr. Vicky's Sauces. They are handmade in Cumbria, and you can find more information out on their website, mrvickys.co.uk. And if you want to order any, email info@mrvickys.co.uk or telephone 01768 210102. Big thanks to Blowhole Brewery, a new beer made on Tyneside. The cans are all designed in the colours of Newcastle United strips from days gone by. Black and white there, the purple and blue, and the good old-fashioned blue from the Entertainers days. But get more information on the Blowhole Brewery range, such as Geordie Juice, from blowholebrewery.co.uk. Thanks to Media Arts for all the help with the technical side of things and video side of things. And thanks to qtechshop.co.uk, the makers of pool tables and snooker tables in Wallsend, Newcastle, and the guys who do our website, nufcmatters.com. If you want to subscribe to the show, then all you need to do is click the subscribe button below. You can also hit the thumb up, which does us a favour, by liking the video, and click share to your social media, such as Twitter and Facebook. We're also available as a podcast on iTunes and Spotify and the rest. And if you want to contribute to the show, use the QR code. It takes you straight to the membership pack and you can join the channel. What do you get for your membership pack? You get a scarf, a cup, a pen and a membership card and entry into the monthly draw. You can also make a donation by hitting the dollar sign in the chat tonight. We also give you something for free if you subscribe to the show. To get your car sticker, email john@nufcmatters.com and he will post you one out. We also support the food bank on this show. And if you want to make a virtual donation to the food bank, then go to nufcfansfoodbank.co.uk and make a donation today. On our website, we've got lots of T-shirts, cups, pens, you name it, memorabilia, if you want to buy it and support the show. For Christmas, we have the Bruno Christmas jumper, which is selling rather well. And we'll have the bobble hats, Play Like Almiron, Bruno's Magic, and Bruno's 39 and Joe Linton's J7. Get yourself to nufcmatters.com to buy them today. If you want to buy people a ticket for one of our events next year. We've got an evening with Steve Howie, which is Friday the 24th of February at the Tyneside Irish Centre. Tickets are £50 from nufcmatters.com or newcastlelegends.com. And you can also buy them on voucher before Christmas. Get somebody a bargain and a nice Christmas present. Peter Beardsley is on the 10th of February at St. Dom's Catholic Club in Newcastle. Tickets available direct from the venue. And for this one, Friday the 2nd of June next year at the Grand Hotel in Gosforth, 6:30 start, an evening with Rob Lee, Lee Clark and John Beresford. To book tickets, contact Natalie at healandtour.org.uk or visit their website, healandtour.org.uk/events. If you're looking for a Christmas present and people like a book, then get yourself NME from the Bender Squad to the Gremlins, or the last remaining copies of Black or White, No Grey Areas, Lee Clark's autobiography, and you can get them from www.badboysbooks.net.